Russell Grant, good morning.
Hello.
You would be a man that would understand what it is like to battle.
Oh, I totally
and battle
understand.
And fight.
I totally understand. I mean, you know that when we first started chatting many moons ago, I was 27 stone. I just felt that William turned off then, didn't you?
Yeah.
that I was 27 stone, and I've now managed to stay at between 15 and a half and 16 stone.
That's incredible.
I started the 5th of Jan, 2009, when I knew that I would die after a couple of heart attacks and lots of other problems. And I found, like you, you see, I couldn't cope with the gym. I found it boring. And at that early stage, I got into disco dance rather than obviously strictly dancing.
It's painful.
And that gave me my impetus for the cardiovascular stuff. But, you know, one thing I do remember, when I did Celebrity Fit Club, about 2004, I think it was, one of the things that Harvey the Marine, who was actually much nicer, as a person than you saw on screen. I mean, the screen image was a bit like Craig Revel Horwood's. He played the, you know, the devil's advocate. And the one thing Harvey said to me was that the impact sports, and that included running and gyms, he took me off all of that, you know.
Did he?
Because he said that your knee joints won't be able to cope with that. And he actually did warn a lot of people that too much running or jogging or whatever they call it can actually do just as much damage to your skeleton, and especially your knees and ankles and other such things, which is another reason why I came off it.
Did you have heart attacks?
I did. I had two serious warnings, which
were... Full-blown heart attacks?
Yeah, they were... They called it an aortic... gosh, I wish I could remember the actual terminology that they gave, but I was in hospital and I was on monitors and everything else, and apparently I had had two where I ended up, well, I'm still on the old angina sprays with the red, little red sprays, and that's when I can get a tightening of the chest. I got pains down one arm and all the rest, and I was rushed into the
local hospital. So you felt yourself having a heart attack?
I did, yes. I felt, in fact, my blood pressure at one point was 215 over something or another. And
what's that
I
mean?
Felt the dizziness. I just felt myself completely imploding.
And that must be a scary, defining moment in your life, because we all, until something goes wrong, we kind of think we're invincible, don't we?
You do. Well, I think the thing is with me, it was, of course, the weight. I was 27 stone, but, of course, there's the psychological thing as well. I mean, as well, you know, we've chatted about it in the past, having lost both my grandmothers and one I was a carer for 9 years. She had Alzheimer's when she left me and passed over. And then my other grandmother in 97, she went, and these two ladies have brought me up. So gradually, you know, you go into a very dark place. I mean, I don't know what the terminology is now. I don't think it's depression anymore. I think they call it bipolar. I'm not sure if there's a difference or it's just a new name. But it's the mental thing. And, I've always said to people who've come to me and said, how did you lose the weight? Well, first of all, find yourself into a situation where you're happy doing the things you want to do. I mean, in 2009, the first thing I decided to do was to go back to showbiz. And I was very lucky because I landed a great play up in Alan Ayckbourn's theatre in Scarborough and met who was to become my very closest friend, Sue Twist, who was in Brookside. She used to play Rosie Banks, who was the traffic warden,
yeah,
who discovered the body under the patio. And so she became a very close friend, and gradually I pulled myself out. But of course, in the long run, physically, if you get yourself in a better psychological place, then you're in a much better position to lose the weight.
And how did you get to 27 stone? Was your diet...
Oh, it was terrible. I used to sit in a chair. I used to sit in a chair and I would just eat. I'd eat either out of boredom or it was comfort eating. You don't actually know you're doing it.
Eat what?
Because you know, you run away from scales. You don't want to know the truth. So therefore, you avoid people or situations where the truth comes at you.
And how much would you have been eating in a typical day?
Oh, goodness me. There would have been bacon and egg and fried bread, maybe 3 or 4 slices of fried bread. There would have been then something at 11 o'clock. There would have been a lunch, which would have been as big as my dinner. So therefore, you'd start eating a big meal at about, oh, I don't know, 12 o'clock. And then you'd go back to it. Mm. So you'd make a big, shall we say, beef stew and dumplings. Homemade dumplings, you know, you wouldn't eat 1 or 2. You would eat maybe 8 or 9 or even 10. And then you'd go back to it at 6 o'clock. So then you'd sit there for the rest of the evening because you didn't want to go out in case people saw you. So you'd watch the television and then you would just continue to eat bars of chocolate, all of the things that I love, cheese, chocolate. So after you've eaten all that, about 9 o'clock, you'd rush to the fridge, see what was in there again. So it'd be cheese and crackers with lots of butter on it.
And at the stage, you're huge at 27 stone.
Yeah.
And your self-esteem must be at rock bottom.
Well, you don't have any. You don't have any. That's why you don't want people to see you. That's why you don't want to go out. I mean, I remember turning down probably my biggest regret professionally when I was at that weight. Catherine Tate was flying high with a series on BBC. And she asked me to join her in a big sketch, actually, you know, do some acting and what have you. And I, there's no way I could have left Wales and go down to London and do it because, A, the thought of that journey down there, because you're breathless. You can't breathe. And especially after the warnings I'd had heart-wise, you used to get a tightening of the chest by just walking from one place to another. You couldn't even go to the toilet. I mean, there's all kinds of things which I won't bring up on radio, but which, you know, I look back at now and I think, you know, that day I went and agreed to do Strictly Come Dancing was the turning point in my life. And, of course, since then, there's no way, for instance, I would have been able to have gone on the stage at the London Palladium and done a huge dance routine, a Charleston and a Samba choreographed by Arlene Phillips, which closed, you know, Act One. There's no way I would have been able to tour in Greece, which is what I've just done, the musical. So, you know, you look back and think, blimmin' heck, you know, losing all that weight really did give me my life back. And now, of course, the irony is, because of the dance factor and because of my relationship with Flavia, we're now about to try and pass that on. And maybe this could be good for you. And try to do some fitness through dance. And that's what we're working on now. Because
and do you think you've cracked
am
it?
Living proof that it can help and does work. Because if you showed me a gym or asked me to run, then I would probably walk in the other direction.
You think you've cracked it?
Sorry?
You've cracked it? You've cracked the cravings? You've cracked the...
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, over Christmas, New Year, I put on 7 pounds, probably everyone did, but already I've started to shed that. I've taken 2 pounds of that off since I was with my dad on New Year's Day, where there were the big family, you know, get-togethers. So I started on January the 2nd. I came back home to Wales, and I've already started to work on getting that off. And I weighed myself this morning and found that already 2 pounds of that has come off.
We're speaking of some of the darker times, and you've been quite open about the effect depression has had on your life. Is that still something you battle?
You get dark days, but I think everybody does. I think we all have dark days. I think one of the problems of living in the British Isles is our weather. I mean, there's this phenomenon called SAD, S-A-D, where the weather, I mean, I'm looking out now at the most beautiful scene of mountains and the sea, but it's pouring down. Now, it doesn't matter so much when I'm at home in Wales, but when you are perhaps stuck in a flat and you've got no focus, you don't know what you're doing with your life. I mean, I've got friends of mine. I mean, I had a friend of mine, for instance. I mean, I heard Boris Johnson going on about there will be jobs for Londoners and Sebastian Coe saying, you know, we're going to give work to local people for the Olympics. I can assure you that a friend of mine, who's a qualified electrician, a really good guy, couldn't get any work for the Olympics at all. He'd lost, not he, but the firm he was working for had lost the NHS contract. So therefore, the work dried up. And the Olympic Games are coming to Stratford. He lived in Stratford. There is a moral to the story. There is an end reason why I'm telling you about depression. Lively, young guy, but couldn't get any work for the Olympics and literally lived the stone's throw, lived in Stratford, couldn't get any work, saw people coming in from all over the place picking up jobs, and he ended up locking himself in his flat for 7 days with serious depression until his mother coaxed him out.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's the kind of thing. And then you hear, you know, the Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, saying, oh, yes, there will be jobs for Londoners and jobs for this and jobs for that. But there are not.
How did...
The jobs are there. Local people couldn't actually get them.
How did depression affect you?
With me, a similar thing, I think. You don't want people to see you. You just basically stay in a room. You don't want to... I think the most serious point I got to was where you don't want to get up. You seriously want to go to bed early so you can fall asleep so that oblivion can rescue you from the demons. And then when it's morning again, you actually don't want to get up because you know that you don't want to face another day where you will just burst into tears for no reason, where you crave the love of people that you've lost, loved ones who comforted you and gave you the security. It becomes that vicious circle, which is why when you listen to, I think it was Jeremy Clarkson and Janet Street Porter, thinking it's de rigueur to have depression, they have no idea. They've no idea. It hits people in different ways and for different reasons.
Well, Jeremy Clarkson said that people who take their own lives on a railway track, their bodies should be left there to be picked up by animals.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
I remember reading some stuff.
That's what he said. Their bodies should be left there to be picked up by animals.
Well,
that's a BBC presenter saying that.
It is an incredible thing and shows a great lack of not just compassion, but also education, knowledge.
But Russell, what did the BBC do about it? Nothing.
But that is the trouble. I mean, all of these things, if they, you know, it's all, the BBC has got its own problems now, hasn't it? Because they have turned a blind eye to too many things like that. But I mean, basically, people should tell either the Jeremy Clarksons or the Janet Street Porters of this world, you know, a lot of people are suffering now through mental health. And I tell you one thing I found interesting. My doctor here in Snowdonia, who was absolutely marvellous, he's retired now, but he explained to me the different kinds of depression. And I had a clinical depression, which means there's a chemical deficiency in the brain. And so I was given these pills and this was meant to supplement whatever it was I was missing. But the interesting fact is that when I then had this kind of transformation psychologically, emotionally, personally, in the beginning of 2009, I took myself off those pills and realized that actually whatever they'd done had already been done and had possibly helped chemically. But I didn't need them anymore. And I think the big danger is people will continue to take them, seeing them as some kind of panacea for their problems. You have to challenge and confront problems.
You said that you chose to go back to showbiz. But do you not think the whole industry, the whole entertainment industry, TV and showbiz, do you not think that provides for an instability that is dangerous?
Oh, yes.
If you want a level playing field and you want to be happy in your life, you know, because you can have big highs in showbiz and then big lows, and you can be doing really well one minute and the next minute you're
absolutely
gone. And does that not frighten you?
I'm in my 60s now.
Yeah, but you've gone back into it.
Well, but I've gone back into it in a different way. Don't forget that my celebrity came through astrology, and it was an unexpected success. Because before that, I was still doing, you know, what I'm now doing now. Pre-astrology, astrology was only ever a hobby. And it was something that Breakfast Television wanted. They wanted the Daily Mirror of the Air, which is what our wonderful leader, Ron Neil, at the BBC wanted to recreate on television. It's never been better at breakfast time in any way, the Franks, the Salinas, and what have you. So I got that in 1983. But in 1980, I was working on a program called The 6 o'clock Show with Greg Dyke and Michael Aspel. So when you work it out, the fact we're now 2013, I've lasted a heck of a long time. Some people maybe only last 6 months a year. So the fact that I returned as a result of becoming well-known as an astrologer, Strictly picked me up and said, would you do this? And then, of course, I went back to my roots, which is very much showbiz roots. Now, as it so happens, I've worked 18 months nonstop. But you know what? If it did end tomorrow, there's so many other things now I learned in what I should have done in my youth, and that is by having other strings to your bow. So, for instance, I'm working with people on a new television and theatre and festival lighting.
And company. also other things in your life. You're in love now, right?
What's that?
Also have other things in your life, have love in your life. And
oh, yeah. I mean, I think the thing is, the important thing that you have to do is to find situations which you love to do. And by having, all of the things that I love doing, I mean, I want to go back over to Los Angeles because I've got family there. I loved it over there. There's so many things that we can do to help ourselves, but the worst thing you can say to somebody in depression or with weight problems or any other problems is snap out of it.
Have you got a civil partnership?
No. No, not at all. I don't believe necessarily in any of those kind of things.
Why not?
Because I think that you're with somebody because you like them, because you love them, but you don't need the law to tell you that.
And obviously it's going to be a big debate throughout the UK. You have David Cameron saying that there should be, as he says, equality in marriage. You've got a lot of members of the church fighting against that. What do you think?
It's an individual thing. I don't think that anybody should take choice away from anyone. I think we all have choice. We all have freedom of will. And I think, if the opportunities are there for people who want to do things, then they should. But as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to choice, when it comes to freedom of will, then we should be given the opportunity to follow whatever path we want. But I don't necessarily think that, you should tar everybody with the same brush. You shouldn't actually think that everybody wants the same thing. And there is a danger of that. The collective will is one thing, but the individual will is something else. And as individuals, we should be allowed to pursue whatever path that we want to, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else.
Russell, I always enjoy talking to you, sir. And thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Stephen. And I have a very happy new year, and obviously to all of your wonderful listeners too.
Thanks a lot, Russell. Happy new year.